in your search, O Nosh-Tulan?
That name is past. I am now Tul.
She grinned, then gathered the reins and kicked her mount forward, the pack horse trailing on its lead. Once the finist was out of her hands, she would focus her talents on discovering this coin-bearer. Until now, she had not allowed herself to think about Opon. She had had too many other, more immediate concerns, like sorry. A strong sense of regret filled her at the loss of Captain Parron. That man would have made her task much easier, possibly even enjoyable. Though he'd been a dour man, getting grimmer by the minute, she had to admit that she had been attracted to him. There might have been something there.
Well, she sighed as she urged her horse up a hillside, dying's never in anybody's plans.
Tool's estimation gave her 2 days at the most. Then the Jaghut would be fully awake and free of the barrow. The finis would have to be securely in place long before then. She looked forward to her meeting with Sori, and instinctively brushed a hand against her sword's pommel. To kill a servant of the shadow, perhaps the rope himself. The Empress's pleasure at that would be immense. She realized that the doubts that had plagued her, born on those dark winds of knowledge, now lay quiescent. An effect of her time in the barrow? More likely this acorn in her pocket. Or perhaps she had moved unconsciously beyond them.
When the time for action comes, all doubts must be discarded.
An old Claw tenet. She knew herself well, and she knew how to control all that was within her. Years of training, discipline, loyalty and duty. The virtues of a soldier. She was ready for the mission, and with this realization, the weight on her shoulders vanished. She urged her mount into a gallop. Crocus craned his head and squinted into the darkness above.
Right to the top, he said. We can see the whole city from there.
Absalar eyed the stairs dubiously.
It's awfully dark, she said. Are you sure this tower is abandoned? I mean, my father told me stories about ghosts, undead monsters, and they always lived in ruined places.
She looked around with wide eyes.
Places just like this one.
Crocus groaned.
The god Krull's been dead for thousands of years, he said. Besides, no one ever comes here. So what would all those monsters do with all that spare time? What would they eat? Tell me that. Stupid stories.
He walked to the foot of the spiral staircase.
Come on, the view's worth it.
She watched Crocus climb upward and hurried to follow before he disappeared from sight. What at first seemed to be impenetrable darkness slowly faded to grey, and Absalar was surprised to find herself able to discern even the minutest details. The first thing she noticed were the soot-stained paintings on the wall to their left. Each stone panel was as wide as a single step, rising half a dozen feet in a jagged procession that mimicked the stairs.
Crocus, she whispered. There's a story painted on this wall.
Crocus snorted.
Don't be ridiculous. You can't even see your hand in front of your face in here. I can't, she thought.
He continued.
Wait till you get up top. Those clouds we saw should have cleared the moon by now. There's something wet on these steps, Absalar said. Run off from up top, he explained, exasperated. No, it isn't, she insisted. It's thick and sticky.
Crocus stopped above her.
Look, will you be quiet for a minute? We're almost there.
They emerged onto a platform bathed in the moon's silver glow. Near one of the low walls, Crocus saw a heap of cloth.
What's that? He wondered. Looks like somebody's been camping up here.
Absalar stifled a gasp.
That's a dead man.
What?
Crocus hissed. Not another one.
He rushed to the huddled figure and crouched beside it.
Blessed Maori, somebody stabbed him in the head. There's a crossbow over here.
He grunted. An assassin. I saw one just like this killed here last week. There's an assassin war going on, just like I told Crupper and Murillo.
Look at the moon,
Absalar breathed from the far side of the platform. Crocus shivered. She was still a cold one, at times.
Which one? He asked, rising.
The shining one, of course.
Feeling contrary, Crocus studied Moonspawn instead. A faint reddish glow suffused it, something he'd not seen before. A worm of fear squirmed in his stomach. Then his eyes widened. Five massive winged shapes seemed to sweep down the moon's face, angling northeast. He blinked, and they were gone.
Do you see its oceans?
Absalar asked.
What?
He turned.
It's oceans. Gralin Sea. That's the big one. The Lord of the Deep Waters living there is named Gralin. He tends vast, beautiful underwater gardens. Gralin will come down to us one day, to our world, and he'll gather his chosen and take them to his world. And we'll live in those gardens, warmed by the deep fires, and our children will swim like dolphins, and we'll be happy, since there won't be any more wars, and no empires, and no swords and shields. Oh, Crocus, it'll be wonderful, won't it?
Her profile was in silhouette. He stared at her.
Of course,
he said quietly.
Why not?
And then that question repeated itself in his head for an entirely different reason. Why not? Book 7. The Fate. The flaying of Fandor, She-Wolf of Winter, marks the dawn of Gedarone. The priestesses race down the streets, strips of wolf fur streaming from their hands. Banners are unfurled. The noises and smells of the market rise into the morning air. Masks are donned. The citizens discard the year's worries and dance across the day into night. The Lady of Spring is born anew. It is as if the gods themselves pause their breath. Faces of Darujistan. Masqueral Jemri, born 1101. Chapter 20. It is said that the matron's blood, like ice, brought forth into this world a birthing of dragons. And this flowing river of fate brought light into dark and dark into light, unveiling at last in cold, cold eyes the children of chaos. Tamartha's children. Hiborik. Murillo wondered again at Ralik's healed wound. He had already concluded that whatever magic deadening powder of Baruch's the assassin had used had been responsible for the healing. Nevertheless, much blood had been lost, and Ralik would need time to recover. Time they didn't have. Was the assassin capable of killing Orr now? In answer to his own question, Murillo laid a hand on the rapier at his side. He strode down the empty street, cleaving the low-lying mists that swirled like incandescent cloaks in the gaslight. Dawn was still 2 hours away. As was the Daru custom, the New Year's celebrations would begin with sunrise, lasting through the day and well into the night. He walked through a silent city, as if he were the last of the living yet to flee the past year's turmoil, and now shared the world with ghosts told among the year's dead. The five tusks had slipped behind in the ancient cycle, and taking its place was the year of the moon's tears. Murillo mused on such obscure arcane titles. A massive stone disc in Majesty Hall marked the cycle of the age, naming each year in accordance with its mysterious moving mechanisms. As a child, he'd thought the wheel magical in how it spun slowly as the year rolled by, coming into the new year aligned precisely with the dawn, whether there was a cloud in the sky or not. Mammoth had since explained to him that the wheel was in fact a machine. It had been a gift to Daruristan over 1,000 years ago by a man named Ikarium. It was Mammoth's belief that Ikarium had Jaghut blood. By all accounts, he had ridden a Jaghut horse, and a Trell strode at his side. Clear evidence, Mammoth asserted, to add to the wonder of the wheel itself, for the Jaghut were known to have been skilled at such creations. Morillia wondered at the significance of the names each year bore. The close association of the five tusks with moon's tears held prophecy, according to the seers. The boar Tenaroc's tusks were named Hate, Love, Laughter, War, and Tears. Which tusk would prove dominant in the year? The New Year's name provided the answer. Morillia shrugged. He viewed such astrology with a skeptical eye. How could a man of 1,000 years ago, Jaghut or otherwise, have predicted such things? Still, he admitted to more than a few qualms. The arrival of Moonspawn threw the New Year's title into a different light, and he knew that the local scholars, particularly those who moved in the noble circles, had become an agitated and short-tempered lot, quite unlike their usual patronizing selves. Morillo turned a corner on his approach to the Phoenix Inn and collided with a short, fat man in a red coat. Both grunted, and three large boxes that the man had been carrying fell between them, spilling out their contents.
"Aye, why, Morillo? Such fortune as Crupper is known for. Thus does your search end, here in this dank, dark street, where even the rats shun the shadow. What? Is something the matter, friend Morillo?"
He stared down at the objects on the cobbles at his feet. Slowly, Morillo asked,
"What are these for, Crupper?"
Crupper stepped forward and frowned down at the three expertly carved masks.
"Gifts, friend Morillo, of course, for you and Ralik Nom. After all,"
he looked up with a beatific smile,
"the Lady Simtal's fate demands the finest in workmanship, the subtlest of design, perfectly mated with ironic intent. Don't you think Crupper's taste is sufficiently expensive? Do you fear embarrassment?"
"You'll not distract me this time," Morillo growled. "First of all, there are three masks here, not two."
"Indeed," Crupper replied, bending down to pick one up.
He brushed spatters of mud from the painted face.
"This is Crupper's own. Well chosen," Crupper pronounces with certain aplomb.
Murillo's eyes hardened.
"You're not coming, Crupper."
"Well, of course Crupper will attend. Do you think Lady Simtal would ever show herself if her long-time acquaintance, Crupper the First, was not in attendance? Why, she'd wither with shame."
"Damn it, you've never even met Simtal."
"Not relevant to Crupper's argument, friend Morillo. Crupper has been acquainted with Simtal's existence for many years. Such association is made better, nay, pristine, for the fact that she has not met Crupper, nor Crupper her. And, in final argument designed to end all discussion, here."
He pulled from his sleeve a parchment scroll tied in blue silk ribbon.
"Crupper's invitation, signed by the lady herself."
Morillo made a grab for it, but Crupper replaced it deftly in his sleeve.
"Ralik will kill you,"
Morillo said levelly.
"Nonsense."
Crupper placed the mask over his face.
"How will the lad ever recognize Crupper?"
Morillo studied the man's round body, the faded red waistcoat, gathered cuffs, and the short, oily curls atop his head.
"Never mind," he sighed.
"Excellent," Crupper said. "Now, please accept these two masks, gifts from your friend Crupper. A trip is saved, and Baruch need not wait any longer for a secret message that must not be mentioned."
He replaced his mask in its box, then spun round to study the eastern skyline.
"Off to yon alchemist's abode, then. Good evening, friend."
"Wait a minute,"
Morillo said, grasping Crupper's arm and turning him round.
"Have you seen Carl?"
"Why, of course. The man sleeps a deep, recovering sleep from his ordeals. 'Twas healed magically, Salty said, by some stranger, yet. Cole himself was brought in by yet a second stranger, who found a third stranger, who in turn brought a fifth stranger in the company of the stranger who healed Cole. And so it goes, friend Murillo. Strange doings indeed. Now, Grappa must be off. Goodbye, friend.
Not yet,
Murillo snarled. He glanced around. The street was still empty. He leaned close.
I've worked some things out, Grappa. Circle Breaker contacted me, put everything into order in my mind. I know who you are.
Grappa cried, withdrawing. I'll not deny it, then. It's true, Murillo. Grappa is Lady Simtal, connivingly disguised.
Not this time. No distractions. You're the eel, Grappa. All this blubbering, sweaty, meek-mouth stuff is just an act, isn't it? You've got half this city in your pocket, eel.
Eyes wide, Grappa snatched the handkerchief from his sleeve and mopped his brow. He wrung sweat from it, droplets spattering on the cobbles. Then a veritable torrent splashed onto the stones. Murillo barked a laugh.
No more magical cantrips, Grappa. I've known you a long time, remember? I've seen you cast spells. You've got everybody fooled, but not me. I'm not telling, though. You don't have to worry about that.
He smiled.
Then again, if you don't come out with it here and now, I might get annoyed.
Sighing, Grappa returned the handkerchief to his sleeve.
Annoyance is uncalled for, he said,
waving a hand and fluttering his fingers. Murillo blinked, suddenly dizzy. He rubbed his forehead and frowned. What had they just been talking about? It couldn't have been important.
Thanks for the mask, friend. They'll come in handy, I'm sure.
His frown deepened. What a confusing thing to say. He wasn't even angry that Grappa had figured things out, nor that the fat little man would attend the fete. How odd.
Good that Cole's all right, isn't it? Well, he mumbled, I'd better head back to check on Raleigh.
Smiling, Grappa nodded.
Until the fete, then. Fare you well, Murillo, Grappa's finest and dearest friend.
Good night,
Murillo replied, turning to retrace his steps. He lacked sleep. All these late nights were taking their toll. That was the problem.
Of course,
he muttered, then began to walk. His features darkening, Baruch studied the Tista Andy lounging in the chair across from him.
I don't think it's a very good idea, Rake.
The Lord raised an eyebrow.
As I understand such things, the event includes the wearing of disguises,
he said with a slight smile.
Do you fear I lack taste?
I've no doubt your attire will be suitable, Baruch snapped, particularly if you choose the costume of a Tista Andy warlord. It's the council that worries me. They're not all fools.
I would be surprised if they were, Rake said. Indeed, I would have you point out the cunning ones. I don't imagine you will refute my suspicion that there are those within the council seeking to pave the way for the Empress. For a price, of course. Power comes to mind. Nobles delving in merchant trades no doubt drool at the prospect of empire trade. Am I far off the mark, Baruch?
No, the alchemist admitted sourly. But we have that under control.
Ah, yes, Rake said. This brings to mind my other reason for wishing to attend this Lady Simtal's fete. As you said, the city's power will be there. I assume this includes such mages as are in your Torud Cabal?
Some will attend, Baruch conceded. But I must tell you, Anamanda Rake, Your debacle with the Assassin's Guild has made a good number of them rue our alliance. They'll not appreciate your presence in the least.
Rake's smile returned.
To the extent that they will reveal their community to cunning council members? I think not.
He rose in a fluid motion.
No, I would like to attend this fete. My own people hold little to such social affairs. There are times when I grow weary of their dour preoccupations.
Baruch's gaze focused on Tista Andi.
You suspect a convergence, don't you? A fell gathering of powers, like iron filings to a lodestone.
With so much power gathered in one place, Rake admitted, it's likely. I'd rather be on hand in such circumstances.
His eyes held Baruch's, their color flowing from dun green to amber.
Also, if this event is as publicly known as you suggest, then the Empire's agents within the city will know of it. Should they wish to cut out Darujistan's heart, they'll have no better opportunity.
Baruch barely repressed a shiver.
Extra guards have been hired, of course. If an Empire claw should strike, they will find their hands full with the Tarud mages besides.
He thought for a time, then nodded wearily.
Very well, Rake. Simtal will accept you as my guest. You will wear an effective disguise?
Naturally.
Baruch climbed to his feet and strode to the window. Beyond, the sky had begun to pale.
And so it begins, he whispered.
Rake joined him.
What begins?
The new year, the alchemist replied. Past is the five tusks. The dawn you see marks the birth of the year of the moon's tears.
Lord Anamanda Rake stiffened. Baruch noticed.
Indeed, an unusual coincidence, though I would put little weight upon it. The titles were devised over a millennium ago by a visitor to these lands.
When Rake spoke, his voice was a ravaged whisper.
Icarium's gifts. I recognize the style. Five tusks, moon's tears. The wheel is his, correct?
Eyes wide, Baruch hissed his surprise between his teeth. A dozen questions struggled to be uttered first, but the Lord continued.
In the future, I'd suggest you heed Icarium's gifts. All of them. 1,000 years is not so long a time, alchemist. Not so long a time. Icarium last visited me 800 years ago, in the company of the Trell Mappo, and Osric, or Osirk, as the local worshippers call him.
Rake smiled bitterly.
Osric and I argued, as I recall, and it was all Brood could do to keep us apart. It was an old argument.
His almond eyes shaded into grey. He fell silent, lost in memories. There came a knock at the door, and both turned to see Roald enter and bow.
Master Baruch, Mammoth has awakened and appears refreshed. More, your agent Kruppum has delivered a verbal message. He extends his regret that he cannot deliver it to you in person. Do you wish to receive it now?
Yes, Baruch said.
Roald bowed again.
The eel will contact you the eve of this day, at Lady Simtal's fate. The eel further finds the prospect of shared information and cooperation intriguing. That is all.
Baruch brightened.
Excellent.
Shall I bring Mammoth to you, Master?
If he's able.
He is. A moment, then.
Roald left. The alchemist smiled.
As I said, he laughed, everyone will be there. And in this case, everyone is an appropriate term.
His smile broadened at Rake's blank look.
The eel, Lord. Darujistan's master spy. A figure without a face.
A masked face, the Tista Andi reminded him.
If my suspicions are correct, Baruch said, the mask won't help the eel one bit.
The door opened again, and there stood Mammoth, looking fit and full of energy. He nodded to Baruch.
Withdrawal proved easier than I'd imagined,
he said without preamble. His bright gaze fixed on Anamanda Rake, and he smiled, then bowed.
Greetings, Lord. I've looked forward to this meeting ever since Baruch brought to us the offer of alliance.
Rake glanced at Baruch and raised an eyebrow. The alchemist said,
Mammoth numbers among the Torud Cabal.
He faced the old man again.
We were deeply worried, friend, given the elder matries at play around the barrow.
I was snared for a time, Mammoth admitted, but at the extreme edges of the Omtos Felak influence. Quiescent regard proved the correct course, as the one stirring within did not sense me.
How much time do we have?
Baruch asked tightly.
2, perhaps 3 days. Even for a Jaghut tyrant, it is an effort to make the return journey to life.
Mammoth's eyes fell upon the mantelpiece.
Ah, your carafe of wine awaits, as is usual. Excellent.
He strode over to the fireplace.
Have you word of my nephew by any chance?
Baruch frowned.
No. Should I have? The last time I met the child was, 5 years ago?
Mammoth said, raising his freshly filled goblet and taking a mouthful.
Well, Crocus has grown somewhat since then, I assure you. I hope the lad's all right. He was...
Baruch threw up a hand and staggered a step forward.
What? He demanded in sudden fear. What's his name? Crocus? Crocus!
The alchemist rapped his forehead.
Oh, what a fool I've been!
Mammoth's face crinkled into a wise smile.
Oh, you mean the matter of the coin-bearer, do you?
Shock registered in Baruch's face.
You knew?
Standing to one side, his charcoal-grey eyes fixed intently on Mammoth, Rake said, in a strangely flat tone,
Mammoth, forgive me for interrupting. Will you be attending Lady Simtal's fete?
The old man nodded easily.
Of course.
Very good,
Rake said, with something like anticipation. He pulled his leather gloves from his belt.
We'll speak then.
Baruch had no time to think about Rake's sudden departure. It was his first mistake of the day. A woman with a shaved head and long flowing robes ran shrieking from the gates, a shred of brown fur streaming from one hand. Adjunct Lorne stepped back to let the priestess pass. She watched as the woman plunged into the crowd behind her. The festival had spilled out beyond Darujistan's walls, and Warritown's main street was a streaming mob she'd spent the last half hour pushing through on her way to the gates. Absently, she rubbed the rapier wound in her shoulder. Her journey into the barrow seemed to have slowed the healing, and an ache had settled inside the puncture, cold as the ice in the barrow's tunnel. Eyeing the two guards stationed at the gate, she approached warily. Only one seemed to pay her any attention, and this man spared her but the briefest glance before returning his attention to the Warritown mob. Lorne entered the city unremarked, simply one more traveller come to attend the spring festival. Immediately within the gates, the avenue split around the base of a squat hill, on which crouched a half-ruined temple and tower. Off to her right rose another hill, evidently a garden, given the wide steps ascending to the summit, covered in trees, and the many fetishes and banners tied to branches and the gas lamps. Lorne's sense of those she sought was strong, unerring. Once past the hills, she could see an inner wall. Sergeant Whiskey Jack and his squad were somewhere beyond it, in the lower city. Lorne strode through the surging crowds, one hand hitched in her sword belt, the other massaging the puffed red flesh around her wound. The guard at Warrigate pushed himself from the wall he had been leaning against and paced a slow circle on the cobblestones. He paused to adjust his peaked helmet, loosening the strap a notch. The other guard, an older man, bandy-legged and short, approached.
"Those fools out there making you uneasy?"
he asked, with a grin more gaps than teeth. The first man glanced through the gateway.
"Had a near riot here a couple of years back," he said.
"I was there,"
the old man said, hawking onto the stones.
"We had to pull the hoods off our polehoms, draw some blood. That sent them packing, and I don't think the lesson's gone on them. I wouldn't worry much. This ain't your regular duty, is it?"
"No, just filling in time for a friend."
"That's the way of it, isn't it? What's your usual round?"
"Midnight till the third bell. Despot's Barbican,"
Circle Breaker replied. He adjusted his helmet again, hoping the unseen friendly eyes had marked his signal. That woman who had passed through a few minutes ago had matched the eel's description perfectly. Circle Breaker knew he wasn't mistaken. She'd looked the warrior, dressed as a mercenary, and trying to hide the bloodstains of a wound on her shoulder. His searching glance had been but momentary. Years of practice, however, made it sufficient. He'd caught everything the eel's messenger had told him to look for.
"That's a grisly watch," the old man said beside him, turning to squint up at Despot's Park. "And you were there to meet the dawn."
He wagged his head.
"The bastard's got us working too hard these days. What with the city infiltrated with Empire spies and the like."
"It doesn't get any better,"
Circle Breaker agreed.
"I'm here for another 3 hours. And you think they'd give me some time to join my wife and kids in the festival?"
The old man spat again.
"No way. Old Beirut's off to stand around watching other people having fun in some bloody estate."
Circle Breaker held his breath, then sighed.
"Lady Simtal's face, I suppose."
"Damn right. Bloody councilmen chuffing around with all their stinking airs, and me with sore feet and all, standing like a statue."
This was a bit of luck, Circle Breaker smiled to himself. His companion's next station was precisely what the eel had wanted for Circle Breaker. Better yet, the old man was complaining about it.
"They need those statues," he said. "Keeps them secure."
He stepped close to Beirut.
"Didn't you tell the sergeant about your bad feet?"
"What's the point?" Beirut complained. "He just delivered them orders. He didn't come up with them."
Circle Breaker looked up the street, as if considering something. Then he laid a hand on the other's shoulder and met his gaze.
"Look, I don't have any family. For me, today's just another day. I'll stand in for you, Beirut. Next time I want some time off, though, I'll come calling."
Genuine relief lit the old man's eyes.
"Nerus bless you," he said, grinning again. "It's a deal, friend. Hey, I don't even know your name."
Circle Breaker smiled, then told him. With most of the revelry out in the streets, the interior of Quip's bar was all but deserted. Adjunct Lorne paused inside the doorway and waited for her eyes to adjust to the gloom. A few desultory voices drifted out to her, mingling with the clatter of wooden cards. She entered the low-ceilinged chamber. A disheveled old woman watched her dully from behind the counter. Against the far wall was a table at which sat three men. Copper coins glinted in the lamplight amid pools of spilled beer on the tabletop. The men held cards in their hands. The man with his back against the wall, wearing a scorched leather cap, looked up to meet Lorne's eyes. He gestured to an empty chair.
"Have a seat, adjunct," he said. "Join in the game."
Lorne blinked, then hid her shock with a shrug.
"I don't gamble," she said,
lowering herself into the rickety chair. The man examined his cards.
"Not what I meant," he said.
The one seated on her left muttered,
"Meant a different game, did Hedge?"
She turned to regard him, skinny, short, with massive wrists.
"And what's your name, soldier?"
she asked quietly.
"Fiddler. The guy losing his coins is Mallet. We've been expecting you."
"So I gather," Lorne said dryly, leaning back. "Your intelligence impresses me, gentlemen. Is the sergeant nearby?"
"Making the rounds," Fiddler said. "Should be by in 10 minutes or so. We've got the back room in this rat trap, right up against a tier wall."
Hedge added,
"Me and Fid dug through that damn wall, 7 bloody feet thick at its base. An abandoned house on the Daru side."
He grinned.
"It's our back door."
"So you're the saboteurs. And Mallet? A healer, correct?"
Mallet nodded, still contemplating his cards.
"Come on, Fiddler," he said. "It's your game. Let's hear the next rule."
Fiddler sat forward.
"Knight of House Dark is the wild card," he said. "That's the opening suit, too. Unless you're holding the Virgin of Death. If you get her, you can open with half ante and double up if you win the round."
Mallet slapped down the Virgin of Death. He tossed a single copper coin into the center of the table.
"Let's run it through, then."
Fiddler dealt the man another card.
"We ante up now, Hedge. 2 coppers apiece, and high hood come the Herald of Death."
Lorne watched the bizarre game proceed. These men were using a deck of dragons. Astonishing. The man Fiddler was inventing the rules as they went along, and yet she watched the cards merge into a pattern on the tabletop. Her brows knitted thoughtfully.
"You got the hand on the run,"
Fiddler said, pointing at the latest card placed on the table by Mallet.
"Knight of Dark's close. I can feel it."
"But what about this damned Virgin of Death?"
groused the healer.
"She's had her teeth pulled. Take a look. The rope's right out of the picture, ain't he?"
Fiddler laid another card.
"And there's the dragon bastard himself, sword all smoking and black as a moonless night. That's what got the hound scampering."
"Wait a minute,"
Hedge cried, ramming down a card atop the Knight of Dark.
"You said the Captain of Light's rising, right?"
Fiddler concentrated on the pattern.
"He's right, Mallet. We pay over 2 coppers each automatically. That captain's already dancing on the night's shadow."
"Excuse me,"
Lorne said loudly. The three men looked at her.
"Are you a talent, Fiddler? Should you be using this deck?"
Fiddler scowled.
"It ain't your business, adjunct. We've been playing for years. Nobody's tossed a dagger our way. You want in? Just say so. Here, I'll give you your first card."
Before she could protest, he placed a card before her, face up. She stared down at it.
"Now, ain't that odd?"
Fiddler remarked.
"Thrown inverted. You owe us all 10 gold each. A year's pay for all of us. Quite a coincidence."
Head snorted loudly.
"Yeah. Also, happens to be the Empire guilt coin paid to our kin once we're confirmed dead. Thanks a lot, Fid." "Take the coin and shut up,"
Fiddler snapped.
"We ain't dead yet."
"I'm still holding a card,"
Mallet said. Fiddler rolled his eyes.
"So let's see the damn thing, then."
The healer set the card down.
"Orb."
Fiddler laughed.
"True sight and judgment closes this game. Wouldn't you know it?"
Lorne sensed a presence at her back. She turned slowly to find a bearded man behind her. His flat grey eyes held hers.
"I'm Whiskey Jack," he said softly. "Good morning, adjunct, and welcome to Darujistan."
He found a nearby chair and pulled it to the table, sitting down beside Hedge.
"You'll want a report, right? Well, We're still trying to contact the Assassin's Guild. All the mining's done, ready for the order. One squad member lost thus far. In other words, we've been damn lucky. There are Tista Andy in the city, hunting us.
Who have you lost, Sergeant?
Lorne asked. The recruit. Sorry was her name.
Dead?
Been missing for a few days now. Lorne clenched her teeth to bite back a curse.
So you don't know if she's dead?
No. Is there a problem, Adjunct? She was just a recruit. Even if she'd been nabbed by the guard, there's scant little she could tell them. Besides, we've heard no such news. Most likely some thugs scrubbed her in some back alley. We've been scurrying down a lot of rat holes trying to find these local assassins. He shrugged. It's a risk you live with, that's all.
Sorry was a spy, Lorne explained. A very good one, Sergeant. You can be certain that no thug killed her. No, she's not dead. She's hiding, because she knew I'd come looking for her. I've been on her trail for 3 years. I want her.
If we'd had a hint of all this, Whiskey Jack said tightly, it could have been arranged, Adjunct. But you kept it to yourself, and that makes you on your own now. His eyes hardened on her. Whether we contact the guild or not, we detonate the mines before tomorrow's dawn, and then we're out of here. Lorne drew herself up.
I am adjunct to the Empress, Sergeant. As of now, this mission is under my direction. You will take orders from me. All this independent crap is over. Understand?
For a moment, she almost thought she saw a flash of triumph in the man's eyes. A second look revealed it to be no more than the expected anger.
Understood, Adjunct.
Whiskey Jack replied curtly. What are your orders?
I am serious in this, Sergeant, she warned, and I don't care how angry this makes you. Now, I suggest we retire to more private surroundings.
She rose.
Your men can remain here.
Whiskey Jack stood.
Of course, Adjunct. We have the back room. If you will follow me.
Lorne reached down to the bed's top blanket.
There is blood here, Sergeant.
She turned to regard the man as he closed the door. He faced her.
One of my men had a brush with the Tista Andy assassin mage. He'll recover.
Highly unlikely, Sergeant. The Tista Andy are all with Caladan Brood in the north.
Her eyes widened in disbelief.
You don't mean to suggest that the Lord of Moonspawn himself has left his fortress? To do what? Hunt down Malazan's spies? Don't be absurd.
Whiskey Jack scowled.
Corporal Kalam and my squad mage had a rooftop engagement with at least half a dozen Tista Andi. That my men survived makes it highly unlikely that the Moon's Lord was anywhere in the vicinity, doesn't it, Adjunct? Put it together. The Moon stations itself just south of the city. Its Lord strikes an alliance with the Rujistan's rulers, and their first task is to wipe out the local Assassin's Guild. Why? To prevent people like us from contacting them and offering a contract. And so far, it's worked.
Lorne thought for a time, then she said,
So, if the guild cannot be contacted, why not do the assassinations yourselves? Your Corporal Kalam ranked among the best in the Claw before his falling out. Why not take out the city's rulers?
The man folded his arms across his chest and leaned against the wall beside the door.
We've been considering that, Adjunct. And we're a step ahead of you. Right now, one of my men is negotiating for us to work as private strong-arms for a highbrow fete this evening. Everybody, who's anybody, is supposed to attend. Council members, high mages, the works. My saboteurs have enough leftover munitions to make it a party this city will have a hard time forgetting.
Lorne struggled against a growing sense of frustration. As much as she had intended to take command of things, it seemed that this Whiskey Jack had been doing just fine up until now, given the circumstances. She suspected she could not have done things any better, though she still doubted the story about the Tista Andi.
Why on earth, she asked finally, would an estate hire a bunch of strangers as guards?
Oh, there'll be city soldiers there as well. But none of them is a bar guest.
Whiskey Jack smiled cynically.
Titillation factor, adjunct. It's what makes the nobility drool. Look there, a big tattooed barbarian glowering down at them. Exciting, yes?
He shrugged.
It's a risk, but one worth taking. Unless, of course, you have a better idea, adjunct.
She heard the challenge in his tone. Had she thought about it, she would have realized long before now that her title and power would not intimidate this man. He had stood at Dasim Ultor's side, arguing tactics with the Sword of the Empire in the midst of battle. And it seemed that demotion to sergeant had failed to break this man. That much she had gathered from the Bridgeburner's reputation at Pale. He would not hesitate to challenge her every command if he found reason to do so.
"Your plan is sound," she said. "Tell me the name of this estate."
"Some woman named Lady Simtal. I don't know the family name, but everybody seems to know her. Said to be a real looker, with influence in the council."
"Very well," Lorne said, adjusting her cloak. "I'll return in 2 hours, Sergeant. There are other matters I must attend to. Be certain that all is ready, detonating procedures included. If you don't get hired, we'll have to find another way of being at that fate."
She strode to the door.
"Adjunct,"
she turned. Whiskey Jack walked to the back wall and pulled aside a tattered hanging.
"This tunnel emerges into another house. From it, you can enter the Daru district."
"Unnecessary."
Lorne was irritated by his condescending tone. As soon as she was gone, Quickben scrambled from the tunnel.
"Damn it, Sergeant," he muttered. "You almost had her walking in on me."
"No chance," Whiskey Jack observed. "In fact, I made certain she wouldn't use it. Anything from Kalam?"
Quickben paced the small room.
"Not yet, but he's about to run out of patience."
He turned to the sergeant.
"So, do you think she was fooled?"
"Fooled?" Whiskey Jack laughed. "She was reeling."
"Paran said she was going to drop something off," Quickben said. "Did she?"
"Not yet."
"It's getting tight, Sergeant. Damn tight."
The other door opened and Trotz entered, his file teeth exposed in something between a smile and a grimace.
"Success?"
Whiskey Jack asked. Trotz nodded. As the afternoon waned, Crocus and Absalar waited atop the tower's platform. Every now and then they peered over the edge to watch the festivities. There was a taste of mania among the crowds below, as if they danced on the rim of desperation. In spite of the season's rejoicing, the shadow of the Malazan Empire hung over all. Indeed, with Moonspawn immediately to the south, Darujistan's place between the two forces was obvious to everyone.
"Somehow,"
Crocus muttered, as he watched the crowds moving down the streets like churning rivers,
"Darujistan seems smaller, almost insignificant." "It looks huge to me,"
Absalar said.
"It's one of the biggest cities I've ever seen,"
she said.
"As big as Unta, I think."
He stared at her. She had been saying strange things lately, which did not seem right, coming from a fisher girl from a small coastal village.
"Unta? That's the Empire capital, isn't it?"
She frowned, which made her look older.
"Yes, only I've never been there."
"Well, how could you know how big it is, then?"
"I'm not sure, Crocus."
"Possession," Cole had said.
Two sets of memory warred in the woman, and the war was getting worse. He wondered if Mammoth had shown up yet. For a moment, he came near to regretting their escape from Mies and Irilta. But then his thoughts turned to what was to come. He sat down on the platform and propped himself against the low wall. He stared at the assassin's body across from him. The blood that had been spilled had blackened under the hot sun. A trail of droplets crossed the floor to the stairs. Clearly, this assassin's killer had himself been wounded. Yet Crocus did not feel in danger up here, although he wasn't sure why. For an abandoned belfry tower, this place had witnessed a lot of drama lately.
"Are we waiting for night?"
Apsala asked. Crocus nodded.
"Then we'll find this chalice?"
"That's right. The Dahls will be at Lady Simtal's fete, I'm sure of it. The estate has an enormous garden, almost a forest. It goes right up to the back wall. Getting in should be easy."
"Won't you be noticed once you join the guests, though?"
"I'll be dressed as a thief. Everybody will be wearing costumes. Besides, there'll be hundreds of people there. It might take an hour or two, but I'll find her."
"And then?"
"I'll think of something," Crocus said. Apsala stretched out her legs on the paving stones and crossed her arms.
"And I'm supposed to hide in the bushes, huh?"
He shrugged. "Maybe Uncle Mammoth will be there," he said. "Then everything will be all right."
"Why?"
"Because that's what Cole said," Crocus shot back, exasperated. Was he supposed to tell her she'd been possessed for who knew how long? "We'll work out a way to get you home," he explained. "That's what you want, right?" She nodded slowly, as if no longer certain of that.
"I miss my father," she said.
To Crocus, Apsala sounded as though she was trying to convince herself. He looked at her when they'd arrived, thinking, why not? And he had to admit to himself now that her company wasn't bad. Except for all the questions, of course. Mind, what if he'd been in her situation, waking up thousands of leagues from home? It'd be terrifying. Would he have held up as well as she seemed to be doing?
"I'm feeling all right," she said, watching him. "It's as if something inside is keeping things together. I can't explain it any better, but it's like a smooth black stone, solid and warm. And whenever I start getting scared, it takes me inside, and then everything's fine again."
She added,
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to push you away."
"Never mind," he said. Within the shadows of the stairwell, Surratt studied the two figures out on the platform. Enough was enough. She had opened her Curald Ghislaine Warren into a defensive layering of wards around her. No more of these invisible enemies. If they wanted her, they'd have to show themselves. And then she'd kill them. And as for the coin-bearer and the girl, where could they hope to escape to? Up here on this tower? She unsheathed her daggers and prepared for her attack. A dozen wards protected her back all along the staircase. An approach from there was impossible. Two sharp points touched her flesh, one under her chin and the other beneath her left shoulder blade. The Tista Andii froze. And then she heard a voice close to her ear, a voice she recognized.
"Give Rake this warning, Serat. He'll only get one, and the same for you. The coin bearer shall not be harmed. The games are done. Try this again, and you'll die."
"You bastard!" she exploded. "My lord's anger
will be in vain. We both know who sends this message, don't we? And as Rake well knows, he's not as far away as he once was."
The point beneath her chin moved away to allow her to nod, then returned.
"Good. Deliver the message, then, and hope we don't meet again."
"This will not be forgotten,"
Surratt promised, shaking with rage. A low chuckle answered her.
"Compliments of the prince, Serat. Take it up with our mutual friend."
The daggers left her flesh. Serat exhaled a long breath, then sheathed her weapons. She snapped a Curald Ghislaine spell and vanished. Crocus jumped at a faint plopping sound from the stairwell. He laid his hands on his knives, tensing.
"What's wrong?"
Apsala said.
"Shh. Wait."
He felt his heart pound hard against his chest.
"I'm ducking at Shadows," he said, sitting back. "Well, we're off soon anyway."
It was an age of wind, sweeping across the grass plains beneath a pewter sky, a wind whose thirst assailed all life, mindless, unrelenting, like a beast that did not know itself. Struggling in his mother's wake, it was Raist's first lesson in power. In the hunt for domination that would shape his life, he saw the many ways of the wind, its subtle sculpting of stone over hundreds and then thousands of years, and its raging gales that flatten forests, and found closest to his heart the violent power of the wind's banshee fury. Raist's mother had been the first to flee his deliberate shaping of power. She denied him to his face, proclaiming the sundering of blood and thus cutting him free. That the ritual had broken her, he disregarded. It was unimportant. He who would dominate must learn early that those resisting his command should be destroyed. Failure was her price, not his. While the Jaghut feared community, pronouncing society to be the birthplace of tyranny, of the flesh and the spirit, and citing their own bloody history as proof, Raist discovered a hunger for it. The power he commanded insisted upon subjects. Strength was ever relative, and he could not dominate without the company of the dominated. At first he sought to subjugate other Jaghut, but more often than not, they either escaped him, or he was forced to kill them. Such contests held only momentary satisfaction. Raist gathered beasts around him, bending nature to his will. But nature withered and died in bondage, and so found an escape he could not control. In his anger he laid waste to the land, driving into extinction countless species. The earth resisted him, and its power was immense. Yet it was directionless and could not overwhelm Raist in its ageless tide. His was a focused power, precise in its destruction and pervasive in its effect. Then into his path came the first of the Aimas, creatures who struggled against his will, defying slavery and yet living on. Creatures of boundless, pitiful hope. For Raist, he had found in them the glory of domination, for with each Aimas that broke, he took another. Their link with nature was minimal, for the Aimas themselves played the game of tyranny over their lands. They could not defeat him. He fashioned an empire of sorts, bereft of cities, yet plagued with the endless dramas of society, its pathetic victories and inevitable failures. The community of enslaved Aimas thrived in this quagmire of pettiness. They even managed to convince themselves that they possessed freedom, a will of their own that could shape destiny. They elected champions. They tore down their champions once failure draped its shroud over them. They ran in endless circles and called it growth, emergence, knowledge. While over them all, a presence invisible to their eyes, Raist flexed his will. His greatest joy came when his slaves proclaimed him God, though they knew him not, and constructed temples to serve him, and organized priesthoods whose activities mimicked Raist's tyranny, with such cosmic irony that the Jaghut could only shake his head. It should have been an empire to last for millennia, and its day of dying should have been by his own hand, when he had last tired of it. Raist had never imagined that other Jaghut would find his activities abhorrent, that they would risk themselves and their own power on behalf of these short-lived, small-minded Aimas. Yet what astonished Raist more than anything else was that when the Jaghut came, they came in numbers, in community. A community whose sole purpose of existence was to destroy his empire, to imprison him. He had been unprepared. The lesson was learned, and no matter what the world had become since that time, Raist was ready for it. His limbs creaked at first, throbbing with dull aches bridged by sharp pangs. The effort of digging himself from the frozen earth had incapacitated him for a time. But finally he felt ready to walk the tunnel that opened out into a new land. Preparation.